The Guardian. Few readers can have failed to notice that the American novelist Jonathan Franzen has been in the UK to publicise his new novel. What with the discovery mid-reading on Newsnight Review that the wrong copy of his book had been printed, to the theft of his glasses from his very nose at his London book launch, it was an eventful visit. But we at the Guardian Book Club don't go in for the most recent book. We look back to one that all his readers have had a chance to look at and digest. So we took advantage of his visit to reintroduce our members to his name-making novel, The Corrections. John Mullen picks up the story.
I wanted to start with a rather general question about, which was a sort of response to what I think lots of people in this country said when they first read The Corrections, which was that for all the kind of fizz and surprise of its sentences, it provided a lot of readers, I think, with what they described anyway as some of the sort of traditional pleasures of novel reading, which maybe they hadn't found in new novels for a while.
I've always tried to write entertaining novels. I never wanted to leave any possible audience behind. My first two novels had more of a thrillerish plot mechanism. It was really plot on the sleeve. Yeah, this was more in-your-face literary than the things I'd done before. But nevertheless, yeah, I wanted you to enjoy yourself. That's the whole point.
And what about that sense that a novelist can be somebody who can actually know what the world is like for more than one character and can expect or help a reader to understand, to sympathise with each one of them?
There was a period of solipsistic male writing, at least in the U.S. You think of Updike and Roth as the great nothing exists outside the self, each in his own way exquisitely good at delivering the most complete imaginable report on what's going on with him on the inside. But that seems more like the anomaly to me. It had always been, that was the great thing about third person. Mm-hmm. Some of the great novels ever written are in first person, but I think third person is the default person. And it's a lovely thing. I'm not sure James Wood knows how fiction works, but in his book, How Fiction Works, he does talk about... he does, I think, appropriately talk about what a wonderfully spongy and capacious thing the loose third person narration is. Sort of, you can slip from outside in someone and back out and leave no fingerprints. It's a clean B&E, that is breaking and entering. And if you don't have the psychological makeup, and I have spent many years of my life finding fault with myself for not being able to be monstrously absorbed in my own sensations the way the solipsistic generation did, and I mean that seriously, felt like it was some failure of masculinity, that I could not just put myself front and center in the book and leave myself there, then the multiple point of view format is particularly attractive.
And in The Corrections, you get this more when you reread the novel, I guess, and you sort of know what's coming. There's quite a strong sense of sort of structural arrangement about whose heads we're going to be in for particular periods of time. The sort of ending of the novel actually is like a little, I was going to say a sort of symphony, but it's more like a chamber piece where we start off with Alfred's point of view.
We start and end with Alfred's point of view.
Yeah, and then we go for a section at a time through each of the five Lamberts, and then we get back to Alfred.
Those formal patterns are fun and almost always accidentally arrived at. I mean, I think of the book as really five short novels. It's my best attempt to reconcile my intense admiration for certain short novels that I was very involved with in the 90s with my inability to write one myself. That is, I always do want to turn it around because I can't put myself directly in a book, and so to just have one point of view all through seemed like, whose would that be? It wouldn't be mine, and again, owing to my incapacities in that way, I'm attracted to a book that has the scope to give surprise of discovering what somebody you've known from the inside looks like from without. And all sorts of different kinds of surprises are possible if the book extends over time. But you lose a certain beautiful, tight, desperate, formal arc when you get away from a novel of maybe 150 pages. If it gets longer than that, it can't have that just driving, relentless pursuit of a character from start to finish. And the books I particularly was admiring when I was trying to get this book going, like Paula Fox's book Desperate Characters and Kansaburo Oe's wonderful novel, A Personal Matter, for which he really did win the Nobel Prize. These are books where someone is fleeing from a recognition. And so I was very, very excited about that possibility, by the comic possibilities of someone fleeing from reality, and reality like a velociraptor relentlessly tracking the person and sniffing them out and driving them up to the next hiding place until finally they have to confront it.
Putting Alfred's point of view, especially as it's a point of view which by the end of the novel is kind of demented, it gives a force to him or to his world, his perceptions, which I think, you know, radically affects the novel. I mean, if you tell the story, I notice if you read reviews of it, they will often say, well, the Lamberts are a family, and then they will, Alfred the patriarch is this kind of rather tyrannical uncle, and immediately start saying things about him, which make him sound profoundly unappealing, and in some sense the cause of the problems that his children have. So choosing a structure where his viewpoint, in a way, is what brackets everything else in the novel. To me, that makes a big difference to what you feel about that official sort of story.
There's no point in pretending that I had not based Alfred in some measure on my father. And he's a cartoon of my father. And it's also catching my dad at a particularly unfortunate moment in his life. And really, I had such an intense sense of identification with him that even when he was demented, we were able to have pretty satisfying conversations in a certain way, sort of sad. But I had the patience to listen, to try to guess, because he was speaking in dream language and I was trying to interpret the dream and help him through this dream that he couldn't get out of. And the things that he was dreaming about were not insignificant. I mean, it's all gibberish in a way, and the neuroscientists are there to tell us just how meaningless our dreams are, and yet, of course, they're not meaningless, because we wake up and then we try to figure them out, and they are peopled by very, very important psychic objects, which is why they're not meaningless. Sometimes they're odd, random details, but often they're recurring figures. I knew my dad well enough that I knew what figures he was referring to, and I knew some of the ways that his mind would work, turning my mother into her mother. And I was going through a dark, dark time in my own life because of struggles with the work and marriage falling apart and having very interrupted sleep. So I was having myself these strange blunderings around in the dark in the middle of the night and these severe dislocations. So to me, the sympathy was automatic. The line that troubles me the most in the book is on the second to the last page. Oh, yes, the sorry facts seem to be that life without Alfred in the house was better for everyone but Alfred. I remember writing that line. I wrote that last chapter in a day. I had to write. I was on a federal civil jury for a major civil rights trial in New York City in the 3 weeks I was trying to finish the book. I remember writing that line and feeling, well, this is very cruel, and it seems to reduce the story to, the problem is just Alfred. Alfred was bad and a tyrant, and all of these bad effects flowed from that, and all of the family unhappiness, and everything seemed to get better with him gone. So I didn't want the line there, and yet it seemed undeniably true. So I still don't really know what to make of that line, because it's not true that all their troubles flow from him by any means. And I think he's actually an admirable figure, and a figure to me of considerable... I mean, it's a sorry thing for a person who values discipline above all else to lose control of his body.
And even more with some of the characters, particularly Chip, I think, are prone to think that their troubles are their father's fault.
That was one reason I was able to leave the book in, because I think it had become pretty clear that Chip was pushing against something that wasn't there.
Yeah.
Then he comes home and, wow, it's just so clear it's not there, and I hope that was clear enough that there was some clue that you're not to conclude the obvious from that line.
And then you get a summary of what's going to happen, of what happens to the characters in the sort of, you know, the year or so afterwards. I mean, why did it
not end there?
Alfred saying, you've got to put an end to it in the hospital. It ended with Chip shaking his head. It ended with him saying, I can't, Dad, I can't. So that is like a real ending sentence. And then it has the epilogue.
I had a better ending sentence in mind, though, so I needed to write the epilogue to set that up. Seriously, I mean, I some 6 months before I finished, I got the last line of this book, which doesn't happen very often. Normally, I'm still trying to figure out the last line about 20 minutes before I write it. But did that disturb you that there were
no,
two endings?
No, not at all. But
there was a lot to cover.
Yeah,
It would not feel at all complete to me if it just ended there, because this is so much Enid's book, and she is relentlessly cartoonized throughout the book. And so you needed something at the end to do some justice to her, I felt. Mm. Here's the thing. This is the book when everything was changing in my life, and they're sort of before the corrections and after. And there's things changed again, but not in the same finally we're getting somewhere way as happened in the 90s. And I had just been so bound up and working so incredibly hard to get the book written, and finally it got going. And I had imagined that there was this entire long chapter after the Christmas chapter, which consisted of all the conversations I'd had with my father when he was demented. So that I'd imagined this another chapter about Chip, in which we're getting the horror of the nursing home, essentially. And also the comedy of the nursing home. And I realized just about 6 weeks before I handed the book in that, no, you're not still 3 or 4 months, 5 months and 150 pages away. You're 40 pages from the ending. And there was this sudden, I was just stricken that I was going to have to let go of this thing. I just felt this stab of pure grief when I realized I don't need that stuff. The Christmas chapter will do it. And I can jump... And it was sort of like finding out you're much closer to your death than you think of yourself. I mean, I've passed into my 50s, but I continue to think the way I still think like a person in his 30s about how much life is ahead of me. And I think I have a feeling the way the end suddenly rushes up at you, I went through with this book. And that's the great thing about writing a book is it is an experience, and it should be an experience. Because the more that the writer has experienced in a real way in writing it, the more likely it is that a reader might be able to have an experience with it. And that transformation, the possibility of transformation is what is on offer. This is all by way of saying I had to fit a lot into a very small space at the end. You wouldn't want that not to be there.
No.
Okay.
No, I wouldn't want it not to be there. I often... want an epilogue with some novels where I haven't been given one. But
right.
But it's funny what you say about Enid, letting her free, because I suppose there's a dialogue, there's a conversation she has, I can't remember with which of her children, actually, quite near the end, where she says, he's not going to go to Philadelphia, is he? This drug's not going to help.
No, that's true.
And, you know, and at that point... It seems to me that's almost like an epitome of what she's been like all the time. Not as so much a deluded person, but somebody who quite often knows.
She knows, but she doesn't know.
Yes.
It's a novel about self-deception. Self-deception is actually a very interesting philosophical problem. How can you deceive yourself? You know the truth, right? How can you deceive yourself? We're also catching her not at the best moment in her life. We get glimpses of her earlier in life and the frustrations, the sexual frustrations of being married to Alfred, and the frustrations of being a very smart woman trapped in a housewife's role, doing, you know, ironing the shirts hours and hours every week. And she's a bright woman. And she's got a demented person, an angry, demented, physically unstable person in a house that's falling apart, and nobody on site to help. So to me, this is, you know, she is willing optimism into herself every minute of the day, and I just find that kind of, I don't know, I meant her to be an object of compassion as well. I found her to be an object of compassion, maybe you should put it that way.
Yeah.
Actually, I wanted to ask you a bit about what you were saying earlier, that you could think of this novel as kind of five, you were saying as sort of almost like five short novels. Because one of the other things about The Corrections, which is, I think, a delight to lots of people, is in a way that it has room for lots of extra detail, which is not necessary to any single-minded plot. Something that you'd forgotten about finding in novels, and which it's no longer were you allowed to enjoy and expect from novels. Sort of almost extra stuff, which was...
The Swedes and Norwegians are extra.
Yeah, yeah, I love the Swedes and Norwegians.
That was really just pure authorial self-indulgence because I liked them so much.
I mean, do we all know about the Swedes and Norwegians, do we? On the cruise ship.
The cruise ship, the bickering Swedes.
Yeah, and there's this great sort of...
The bombshell and the praying mantis.
And there's a sort of syncopated dialogue. I don't know, there should be a literary critical term for it, but I don't think there is, where several conversations are in effect happening at the same time, but sort of unnoticed by each other. And what we as a reader notice that the Swedes and Norwegians are locked in some sort of rhetorical death struggle, aren't they? most of the time, the sort of details and sometimes little lists that you use have some particular purchase in the perception of the character in a way that we're with at the time. But there are also things, I don't know, there's something one... De Quincey said about some stuff in Daniel Defoe's novels, when he tells us all the details about certain subsidiary characters, and we think, why are we being told this? And the answer is, the only reason I'm being told this is because it's true. You know, and there's kind of...
At the very beginning of the English novel, there was a lot of figuring out of what information was necessary and what wasn't. And there was a lot of anxiety in the early decades about the fact that it was untrue. Just like, what do we need to do in order to establish verisimilitude? What do we do in order to sort of establish the bona fides of this fictional story? So some of that seems, at this point, clumsy. Just because it's, you know, he was really figuring out the form as he worked. Not to say that I've never been guilty of clumsiness.
No,
myself.
No. Well, I'm not sure if...
We're still reading Defoe.
Yeah,
after all.
And I was just thinking, I don't know, when I was finding out about Robin's husband's, when I was finding out about his kind of his musical tastes, and I was, you know, I mean, that seemed to me an example of, and he goes to his office and he plays these kind of comically sort of slightly edgy rock music things, even though he's a sort of he's actually a sort of corporate man in a way.
Right.
And there seems something entirely convincing about this. And the fact that I didn't need to know it in some ways made it all the better.
Yeah, I wonder about the sort of the pop cultural references. But when you throw in a band like Mission of Burma, if you know Mission of Burma's stuff, I may be the only person in the room who knows Mission of Burma's stuff. They were. In their short life, a great American band. But if you don't, I think you still get something from the name Mission of Burma.
I think you get something from this, from the idea of Brian sitting in his office.
Oh, certainly, absolutely. Yeah. And it wouldn't be, you know, he was sitting there listening to Bruce Springsteen then it doesn't have the same live in the dream baby quality.
Yeah, yeah.
He's getting to be the cool, you know, the hipster guy and the corporate guy. Yes.
Please, I will try to sort of fairly look around. So if anybody has something they want to say or ask,
but you
Jonathan,
must wait
just
for the microphone.
Stick your mitt up, please, and I will get a microphone to you.
I was particularly intrigued by this loving the Norwegians and the Swedes. And I felt that the chapter about going on the cruise on Gustav Myrdal was fantastic. And you could sort of feel how... I mean, I felt that Enid, in some way, was like a take on an Ibsen heroine, this woman who had been locked into this family surrounding from which she couldn't get out. And when she got onto this cruise, I mean, it was fantastic.
She goes to the Henrik Ibsen room at a certain point. Is that
yes,
the Soren
and the Pippi Longstocking ballroom.
Yes.
And the Kirkedal something or other. I was just waiting for Dag Hammarskjöld to come. But I thought she was wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. That's my kind of question, too.
Yes, there's a lady in the middle.
It's another question about the cruise, I'm afraid. I was dying for an excuse to ask you about David Foster Wallace.
Right.
Was the cruise stuff sort of inspired, you know, his brilliant essay about going on that ghastly cruise, a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again? Was that concurrent? Did you talk about the horribleness of luxury cruises and how unfulfilling they are, or was it a coincidence?
That's just one of those things. I think I had read his cruise ship article, but I had my own sources on cruises. shall we say, and although he made up most of the stories in that nonfiction piece, do you really think someone asked what time the midnight buffet was? The interesting thing was I have been on one cruise in my life myself, and that cruise was scheduled for August 1997, and I was desperately writing the cruise ship chapter in May, June, and July of that year because I was determined to get it done before I set foot on a cruise ship because I didn't want to know what it was really like.
Hi, you talked a lot about the context in your personal life at the time that you were writing this, and there's obviously lots of semi-autobiographical details in the book, and I just wondered about... you get the strong impression that it was writing as therapy, and whether that troubled you as you were writing it, and whether there was a concern about the impact of that on the reader's experience and how entertaining the novel was, and whether there was a tension there for you in that.
If therapy is some sort of dopey, self-esteem bolstering, find some useful fictions to make yourself feel better kind of thing in your mind, then with some silly narrative of exercising dark moments from your past, getting them down, and to hell with the reader, felt good, you felt it was a cathartic thing for you, and you felt better for having done it. If that's your notion of therapy, then this was not a therapy project. If by therapy you mean something a more difficult engagement with the really intractable and insoluble problems and the long-term struggle to see yourself a little bit more clearly and to identify patterns of thought a little bit more clearly and have things that you formerly had no control over, conflicts and anxieties, seem a little bit more objectively observable so that you still feel them but you're not so controlled by them and you might be able to function a little better. If that's your idea of therapy, then maybe this is a therapy project. But the therapy is actually off stage. The book is not the therapy project. The therapy has to be done. The engagement with the self and the going into the most shameful places and the going into the most anxious places, that has to be done. But that's for me, that's work that gets done off stage, so that precisely I am not inflicting the raw stuff. It's not a primal scream. I'm trying to spare you the primal scream. I'm trying to give you something fun and funny. Although on this topic of funniness, I was realizing, listening to that those lines of Enid's from her Christmas note, her shorter note, that I could not write this book now, because I had a somewhat impossible mom, who is also a great mom, and who is much more, she had many more dimensions than we see in Enid, but she could be infuriating like Enid. And one of my functions in the family was to be very, very skilled at being funny about her, primarily to protect my own sanity and the sanctity of my psyche when I was growing up, but also as a gift to my brothers, to get them laughing about the same things and try to defuse everything. And hearing that, I find that I've changed to the point where I now think so fondly of my mom, so much more fondly than when I was writing this, that I don't think I could bear to be so merciless about some of her speech patterns, because, again, no denying, some of Enid's speech patterns were my mom's own. Even the short Christmas note was my mom's own. Full disclosure. So this is sort of a singular book in that regard. It will never come again.
When I read the corrections, I was very struck by the way that this very vividly realized interiority of people's minds and lives was set against this wider framework of the political and the economic of the company that Alfred worked for and the Eastern Europe staff and the whole economic framework. And it's obviously very important to the whole way that the novel is conceived as well. So I wondered if you could say something about that.
The book didn't drop like a little seed crystal into my fertile brain and spring into perfect crystalline form. It had a long and labored history of failed efforts to get it going, and grew out of a rather different, a very, very different looking, heavily plotted book. So certain things came along. Some scaffolding was necessary in order to bind the five short novels together. And there was also, frankly, I felt my first two novels hadn't gotten quite as much attention as I felt they should. So there was a certain tour de force impulse behind this book, where I wanted to do not only five short novels, but I wanted each one to be different in tone, structure, and theme. So just to like, I can do it not just once, I can do it five times. And I can do it five times in one book, so there. was some of the angry 30-something male writer's impulse. The history of Alfred's company is, in fact, very, very important, because a lot was contained in the basic premise, which is you have these two almost Old Testament 19th-century parents out in the now obsolete and post-industrial Midwest, and you have these relatively hip modern kids on the coast. And the old man is falling apart, and the mom wants everyone home for Christmas, and that's basically the book. But even there, you get into what does it mean to be in this post-industrial place? And that kind of makes me interested in what the industrial part that we're now post from, and all the medical stuff and the financial froth on the medical discoveries. That's part of being hipper, smarter on the coast. You know better. Mom and Dad were stupid financially, stupid, stupid, stupid. We're really, really smart. That's one version of being more sophisticated on the coast. So a lot of these things some of it was just found along the way, and I would describe what's left as the three or four plot lines from a 20-plot-line book that was unwritable that didn't get discarded. Most things got discarded, or they're in very vestigial form, like the prison stuff.
I just wanted to announce that Jonathan will do, for those of you who are interested, with some signings afterwards, and just to thank him for such an interesting and fun evening.
For great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.